Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to look, as I did do a few months ago, at the politics of conscription. And particularly, we're going to look at the role of the post-war Labour Foreign Secretary, Ernest Bevin, and his particular views on the threat posed by communism, by the Soviet Union, and his belief that a large and well-equipped and well-manned British army would have to continue into the foreseeable future in order to police what remained of the British Empire, but also to present a significant fighting force that could be deployed to continental Europe at any time. And so today we're going to look at National Service by Richard Vinon, a brilliant British social historian who has written extensively on topics such as suffrage, and his exploration of Ernest Bevin. So it's worth pointing out that with the exception of the First World War, by the end of the Second World War, conscription had never really been a significant feature of British military recruiting or British social life. The idea that the individual had this innate obligation to the state was contrary to British liberalism, and it was also contrary to British military requirements throughout much of British history. British armies tended to be small with large navies, and so British expeditionary forces would tend to join with larger continental allies that would do the heavy lifting, but would help form coalitions and then use naval power to attack the enemy, be it Napoleon or the Kaiser, from the periphery. It's only the First World War that starts to really change that and force Britain to recruit mass armies and raise armies of millions from the civilian population. And it's only halfway through the First World War in 1916 that recruitment is introduced anyway. And in 1916, it is largely the product of a Daily Mail hoo-ha and nonsense. The British Army actually has a surfeit of volunteers. They have more volunteers, even in 1916, even in the year of the Somme, than they can arm and equip. Daily Mail managed to create a moral panic over the subject of conscription, suggesting that there were shirkers and idlers back at home, people that weren't doing their bit. It made a great ink for the Daily Mail, lots of problems for Asquith, and eventually provided Lloyd George with the means by which he could become Prime Minister. Okay, so at the end of the Second World War, generals and politicians began to really debate seriously whether National Service had to continue and whether it should be abolished. The end of conscription would have been very, very difficult. Britain has, at the end of the Second World War, huge global commitments, not just due to their empire, but due to parts of the world such as Greece, for example, that if the British simply withdraw from, might tip over into communist rule. The British have an occupying army in Germany, obviously. The Second World War had given Britain obligations in places that they never considered to be in their interests. For example, the British Army that periodically has to occupy Vietnam. Richard Vinen writes, "In the short term, troops would be required to police areas that the British occupied. In the longer term, it was unclear what kind of military obligations might fall on Britain. Though politicians from both sides believed that Britain should remain a great power with influence throughout the world, the loss of India, which seemed inevitable to many by the end of the war, meant that Britain would abandon some of its garrisons, but it also meant that it would lose the use of Indian troops, many of whom had served outside the subcontinent. Various expedients were discussed. The British negotiated to maintain some Gurkha soldiers from Nepal. They used prisoners of war from Germany, Italy and Japan to provide labour for years after the end of fighting. Polish units remained with the British Army until 1949, and the government contemplated creating a foreign legion which would recruit from that substantial pool of young men in Central Europe who had lost their homes and or acquired a taste for fighting during the previous 5 years. People close to the army continued to advocate a British foreign legion in the 1950s. More seriously, the services recruited women, something that they had never previously done in peacetime. None of these expedients were sufficient to produce the troops in the numbers required, but there was no formal decision about post-war conscription, perhaps just because ministers took it for granted." So it was assumed that there would be some kind of post-war conscription, because in the environment of 1945, it was entirely possible that there would be a future conflict with the Soviet Union, or that a considerable show of strength would be the one thing that would prevent that. Between Germany's defeat and that of Japan, the British government changed. Churchill's wartime coalition was replaced with a Labour government during the general election of July 1945. So the Labour Party double their representation, well, more than double their representation. They have one of the biggest victories in parliamentary history, going from 154 seats to 393. They had an absolute majority, and the Tories lose 190 seats. And it was an election fought largely on domestic affairs. There was very little discussion of foreign policy issues, very little discussion of military matters, and very little discussion of conscription or national service. However, despite the fact that Labour's manifesto, Let Us Face the Future, focused mainly on domestic issues such as employment, social welfare and the planned National Health Service, the Labour government would be presented with an extraordinarily challenging foreign policy environment over the next 6 years of its life. Dealing with the loss of India from the British Empire, the developing civil war in Palestine, and in 1950 the outbreak of the Korean War. Challenges such as the Berlin Crisis, 1948-49, and the Greek Civil War. So that was to name just a few of the foreign policy commitments that Labour would face. Now, there had been, by and large, a socially stratified British army, the officer class, largely public school, Oxbridge, assumed that Churchill would win. They assumed that Churchill would be rewarded for his endeavours as a national figure during the war. The working class, rank and file, young working class men, were more than likely to vote Labour. Labour voters themselves nationally wanted change, and this meant to respond to a manifesto that explicitly promised better living conditions healthcare and houses in the post-war era. It's not to say that the Conservative Manifesto didn't hint at some of these things, but they really played the game and thought that losing sides tend to in scenting which way public opinion is going and giving some token efforts towards it, but really allowing the population to look at the other side and say, well, if we want the real thing, we will vote for it. So there had been a strong vein of anti-militarism through the Labour Party in the 1930s. It was much weaker after the Second World War, partly as a result of the experience of the war and the fact that many of the newer MPs had served during the war, and there had been a collective agreement that the Second World War and the Spanish Civil War that preceded it, which had a strong contingent from the Labour Party within it, had both been worthwhile struggles against fascism. Labour was also intimately connected with the development of multilateral institutions after the war, particularly the United Nations, but also the Bretton Woods institutions that promised to maintain world order and economic stability, and also maintain the principle of collective security. And it was believed that Britain would need substantial armed forces to contribute to United Nations collective security, and would also need substantial armed forces in order to fulfil its role as a kind of regional and global policeman. This role was only to last for a few years until Britain's near bankruptcy in 1947. Global policeman really meant a bulwark against communism. It was one of the great regrets of Harry Truman that he cancelled Lend-Lease in 1945 and forced the British into accepting a loan on very unfavourable terms, because that meant a steep decline in British world power and a transition to America as not just being the global hegemon, but also the global anti-communist fighting power, the power of the Truman Doctrine. Now, if you go back half a dozen podcasts or so, I've done some of the very complicated politics of the Truman Doctrine that were by no means a simple declaration by Truman that communism must be stopped. America did not have, in between 1945 and 48, a united public opinion and united public front on the subject of intervention in the Cold War. It's far more ambiguous than that, and often more hassle than Truman himself wanted. So let's talk about Ernest Bevin. He was the most significant figure within the Labour Party regarding the subject of conscription. Figure of extraordinary ability and widely respected on both sides of the House. He had been a lorry driver during the 1920s and 30s, and had eventually become the head of the Transport and General Workers Union. During the war, he was the Minister for Labour and National Service. And in the Labour governments of 1945 to 51, he occupied the role of Foreign Secretary. He was the man who spoke for Britain. The coherent thinking, if there was any, that underlay the British attitude towards post-war military service could be and was referred to at the time as Bevinism.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Though the political outlook of Bevin was more down to Bevin's own gut feeling than a clearly articulated set of ideological positions. Bevin was a fierce anti-communist. So it's one of the great misunderstandings about the Labour Party throughout the 20th century is that it has been particularly associated with the radical left. Almost since its inception, the Labour Party has rejected the revolutionary left from the Independent Labour Party all the way to the Communist Party of Great Britain. During the 1930s, Bevin, as a trade union leader, came into contact frequently with the Communist Party and had consistent run-ins with their overtly Stalinist positions. He was well aware of the activities of the Communist Party in Great Britain, and he was also party to intelligence on potential communist agents, of which there are a significant number. Bevin thought that Britain should remain a great power when discussion of the atomic bomb was being tabled. Bevin said, we need one with the Union Jack on it. And both he and Churchill believed that it would be atomic power, atomic military power, that would safeguard Britain's place at the top table of world affairs. This lesson was not lost on France either, and both decolonising powers struggled very quickly to acquire nuclear weapons as rapidly as possible. And so Bevin was on the right of the Labour Party and classed himself as a working-class patriot. He was not dissimilar to Harold Wilson in this regard, who during the 1950s and 60s was less interested in, was certainly disinterested in European affairs, and also disinterested to a greater degree in a pan-Atlantic or transatlantic relationship. Wilson in the 1960s viewed Britain's position as being able to be the lead nation in the Commonwealth, but at the same time being a relatively meritocratic and social democratic country that managed to provide decent standards of living for Britain's working classes. And both appealed to a kind of working class Toryism in a way that spoke to a deep working class instinct in Britain towards national pride, patriotism, and a sense of, whilst having a sense of deference, still a sense of respect towards British institutions which had been fought for in two world wars. Richard Vinen writes, Bevin's position with regard to military service was odd. On the one hand, his personal links to the trade unions were closer than those of any other minister. On the other hand, as Minister of Labour and National Service, he had been closely associated during the war with the one thing the trade unions most disliked, the direction of industrial labour, and, in particular, the conscription of young men for work in mines. After the war, he occasionally spoke as though he regretted that military service did not go with some broader project of social levelling. Addressing boys from Emmanuel School in South London, which stood on the awkward frontier between grammar and public school, as well as that between officers and other ranks. He said, "It must be as easy for the miner's son to enter the professions as for the son of the middle-class home to enter the steel plate industry or go down the mines. The broadest possible view of national service must be taken by all." So, in order to maintain the goodwill of the trade unions, the government decided to limit the social aspect of national service. Post-war military service would be separated away from civilian work. So there would be, during a period of post-war national service, no equivalent control of civilian manpower directing workers to whatever role it suited the government to direct them to. Military service would be universal for young men, but all other forms of compulsory service, such as the factories and the mines, would be abolished. There was very little discussion of conscripting women for military or civilian roles once the war had ended. Even in the Royal Army Medical Corps, there was no call-up of women at the end of the war. One possible explanation for this was the focus that the Labour government had, in fact, nearly all post-war governments across Europe had, at the end of the war, on natalism, on increasing birth rates, making sure there were large numbers of children, large cohorts of children being born every year in order to supply industry with a significant amount of manpower eventually when they grew up. So it was Bevin's influence that secured from the Labour Party the agreement to institute post-war conscription. When Clement Attlee was attending the San Francisco conference, this was decided, and it was obviously the San Francisco conference that led to the founding of the United Nations. One day after the German surrender on May 8th, 1945, Bevin met with the Tripartite Committee, which brought together the Parliamentary Labour Party, the Labour Party's National Executive, and the Trade Union Conference. So he persuaded the committee to support conscription, and he said that this should happen. He made several kind of cunning plays. He pretended that it wouldn't last for long after the war, even though he was certain it would do. Obviously, it lasted until 1963. That service would be limited to just 1 year, whereas he knew that it would only make sense for soldiers to be at least in uniform for 18 months, and that it would contribute to collective security. That there was more than likely at the United Nations going to be some big breach with the Soviet Union, which, if they withdrew from the principle of collective security, would mean that the whole idea would be undermined. And so other nations needed to be able to provide as much manpower as was possible. And collective security, ensuring a safe post-war world, was the key aspect that of Labour foreign policy and was music to the ears of members of the NEC particularly. Labour attitudes were complicated, and they were complicated by a minority of dissident MPs within the Parliamentary Labour Party, and, more importantly, by a sense that the party was the heir to the anti-militarist and anti-conscription traditions that had existed during the 1930s. So people carrying on ideas that had been seen as noble and progressive before the failure of appeasement. There were significant figures in the cabinet who opposed conscription when it was first discussed in 1945, and some Labour MPs criticised it on pacifist and anti-militarist grounds, or sometimes that it referred to, it went back to the kind of the dilemmas that the Liberal government had faced during the First World War. Ellis Smith, for example, who's Labour MP for Stoke, referred to Sydney Street, Antwerp, Gallipoli, and the responsibility of Mr. Churchill when he was a young man, sending forces to Liverpool and Salford because dockers were taking a stand on trade union rights. So what Ellis Smith was suggesting was that perhaps the Labour government might not use a large conscripted military force against the working classes, but possibly a future Conservative government might. And Mr. Churchill himself was by no means a spent force in British politics. This seems fanciful now, but given the period of unrest and the willingness in the 1920s, particularly, to deploy force to discipline Labour, the Labour Party itself were mindful of this. So, for a great many Labour MPs, it was considered to be an irrelevance. James Callaghan, later Prime Minister, who served as a naval officer during the war, was the spokesman for ordinary servicemen who resented those who gained exemption from service or received special treatment while they're in the forces. On the other side of the party, one of the few figures on the left of the party who supported conscription was Michael Foot, who had been the author of the pamphlet Guilty Men in 1940, which had laid out criticisms against Chamberlain and other Conservatives for the horrors of appeasement. Michael Foot believed in conscription in solidarity with many Continental Socialists because he thought that a large army would be a democratic army and it would be a defender of democracy and peace, and that that is what its role would be. Criticisms of the policy of conscription provided some MPs with a means of attacking Bevin himself. So the rivals to Bevin were able to maintain a great deal of capital out of it. One, Richard Crossman, later of the Richard Crossman Diaries fame, demanded or claimed that Anglo-American Entente would make war more likely rather than less, and that Britain was being forced to adopt conscription in the interests of America. Well, it ultimately, to some degree, in some instances, does serve the interests of America, but largely unintentionally. There seems to be little evidence that Washington was placing this kind of pressure on Great Britain. And there, just for now, we must leave things. We'll continue with this bit by bit in the not-too-distant future, and examine further the British political and social ramifications of conscription. And Britain kind of really as a cipher for Britain's world role after 1945. Anyway, I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.